about the people that I've asked to participate, and I want to make sure that we all have time afterwards also for questions. So let me begin by first introducing the panelists, and then I'll be the first respondent. Our second panelist will be Thomas L. Durham, and Tom is a very old friend of at least 30 years. And well, he's not elderly, he's just a very old friend. And I really appreciate Tom agreeing to speak on this panel because he is a professor at BYU, and even though this is not a controversial subject, the fact that he's here is controversial. We really appreciate those people from BYU who have agreed to participate in this symposium. Tom has, he's a professor of music at BYU and has three children, is currently married, and I'll let him explain his, he has a great marriage, so. Okay, Carol Lear is also a very old friend of at least 30 years. The three of us went to junior high school together. And Carol is an attorney for the State Board of Education. Has three children, married to John Lear, and they also have a great marriage. And a lot of this focus is, this isn't just a lot of people getting up and telling you all their bad experiences with infidelity. This is people who are talking about how to avoid infidelity. Okay. The next panelist will be Michelle Hawes, and Michelle and Len are married. Michelle is in a second marriage. I believe she was married for something like 14 years and is currently, what, about 7 or 8 years in a second marriage. And so I appreciate the different perspectives she will bring. She's working on her PhD in communications at the University of Utah. And her husband, Len, is a professor of communications at the University of Utah. And both of them are mediators. They can explain what that means. They also have done some facilitating for LifeSpring, and they've spoken a lot on marriage and relationships, and so they will bring an interesting perspective as well. I am Robin Knibbe, and I am divorced. I've been divorced about 3 years. I was married for 19. I have three children. I own a business called Sweet Shirts, and I am on Sunstone's Board of Trustees. Oh, I have four. Well, everyone else had three, and gee, Tom has three. Well, I have four. Thank you. I'm glad. I have a few friends out here who know how many children I have. Okay. Currently, more than 60% of husbands and almost that many wives in the United States were estimated to have a sexual encounter after marriage with someone other than their spouse. A tidal wave of infidelity is sweeping the country and leaving in its wake many victims. I am a victim of infidelity, and I like to call infidelity a form of emotional abuse. We talk a lot about the victims of sexual and physical abuse, but there are many more men and women suffering as victims of an unfaithful spouse. And I'm not going to dwell on this aspect of it, but I want to give you one example of some of the pain and the trauma that is involved. One of my most vivid memories of about 4 or 5 years ago was right after I had learned about this other woman, and my ex-husband had just been through a church court, and he'd been a bishop. And my whole life was just turned upside down. And I remember for that month or so, not even knowing what I needed to accomplish or do, everything was
topsy-turvy. And I remember one day being asked by someone in the ward to take a dinner in to someone, a neighbor who had her daughter had just broken a leg and was in traction and was home. And I took this dinner, and it was really a sacrifice to me to get that dinner prepared because my kids weren't getting dinner at this time. And as I took the dinner in, her house was immaculate. And her daughter, yes, had a broken leg and was incapacitated. But I thought, I am the one who needed this dinner. Because a lot of times we're ready to recognize those who need the physical things, but we don't always aren't always as in tune to those with the emotional needs at that time. And it was a real vivid memory, and that's one of the things I remember most about that time. But rather than discussing all of the pain and trauma involved, I've chosen to focus on ways to strengthen a marriage, to avoid the temptations of infidelity. That's why I named the panel Fidelity in Marriage. I'm going to ask four questions, not necessarily answer them, but throw them out and discuss them. First question is, should marriage partners be allowed to develop friendships with members of the opposite sex? Now, if we describe friendship as a non-sexual relationship, what level of intimacy is appropriate in friendships outside of marriage? Plato said that friends are best chosen among non-lovers because lovers have their judgment obscured by passion. It is the souls of friends that become united and not their bodies. Then there is also the question of whether or not men and women can be friends with one another. I do believe there's a difference between friendships among members of the same sex and members of the opposite sex. I do not love my closest man friend any less than I love my closest woman friend. But it is true that for all of our differences, my woman friend is closer to being another self than is my man friend. We've never had to be guarded with each other because of sexual hopes or expectations attached to our relationship. We've been able to share dimensions of our vocational and sexual lives that are unique to us simply because we are women. One friendship is not better, it is just different. Perfect friendships may be rare, but there is no expectation that they be restricted to one friend only. Having more than one friend assumes no infidelity. But in contrast, marriage assumes that there is only one sexual partner, and any deviation from that is an infidelity. For those who are married to say they do not need any friends may well place too great a burden and undue stress on the marital relationship. It's impossible for one other person alone to be their friend, lover, companion, soulmate, sports partner, and confidant. Seldom does one marriage partner satisfy more than 80% of another's needs and aspirations. So I guess my answer to that is that we need to have friends outside of marriage. It's just a little hard to keep that friendship without allowing it to become a something other than a friendship. Question number two, what do you do if you find yourself in an intolerable marriage? Do you stick it out in quiet desperation? And is divorce justified? And I think in the church that we really need to admit that sometimes unwise choices or mistakes are made when choosing marriage partners, especially when we make those choices when we're very young. And I want to refer now to the handout, How Love Ends, because when you find yourself in a situation where you're in, say, stage two through five, a lot of people experience number one in their, everyone will experience that stage in their in their marriage. But when you get to the point where you're focusing on what your needs are that are not being met, and you look at your disappointments or disillusionments, and you focus on that where you used to be satisfied before, and all you do is notice your spouse's negative traits, then your marriage starts to be in trouble. And at this point, though, that is when you need to get some marriage counseling, because the marriage can be turned around. When you reach the point where you think the relationship is over, it's no longer worthwhile, one spouse has quit working on the relationship, you no longer remember the good things, you only remember the bad, then you get down to the point where things really aren't as salvageable. And then after the threshold, the spouse goes through a perception change, and when that happens, things do not really change radically. It's just their perception of how things are changes. And then you reach the point where you're looking for verification to validate those perceptions. You may hire a lawyer, and really the love has ended. And this works not only in a marriage, but this happens in relationships as well. Okay, so my point is that if you get to that point where you are deciding about divorce and ending a relationship, I think you need to make the decision and get divorced rather than say, I'm going to look for someone else, and if I find someone else, then I may leave my marriage. That is the problem. I firmly believe that that it is not how we treat someone that we love, or that someone we loved enough to marry, to treat someone that way by first going out and finding someone else to replace you, then getting out, using that as an excuse to get out of the marriage. Now, I'm going to make an analogy here. Normally, I'm not interested in cars. I don't pay a lot of attention to cars. They're just a necessity. I don't like to clean my car, get it repaired. But currently, I have a Jeep that has about 120,000 miles on it, and it's become expensive to maintain and operate, and it's becoming undependable. So I decided a few months ago that I was going to get a new car. I made that decision. And all of a sudden, once I made that decision, I started noticing cars wherever I went. My head would turn whenever a real cute car would come down the road. I'd drive up and down parking lots looking at cars and thinking about what kind of car I was interested in. And, you know, I decided I wanted one that was real sporty, and it had to be red, and it had to have one of those little spoilers on the back. And then I started making specific decisions about brands or models that I liked, and I read consumer reports, and I started frequenting State Street and Ogden and the Provo dealerships. And, you know, I collected salesmen's business cards, and because I wanted to make sure that I really made an educated decision and made a good choice, because I felt like this car was going to be with me for a while. And well, I think men and women that are unhappy in their marriage and are looking for someone else are very similar. You can tell the difference. They notice someone. They notice people wherever they go. Whereas before, they probably didn't pay attention to a good-looking woman. And their heads turn whenever, you know, an attractive man walks by. They send out a clear signal that they are available and that they're interested. And I really noticed this with my ex-husband, because people would say, yeah, he's kind of flirting. And I said, a lot of people flirt, but there is a difference Some people flirt, but they send out a clear message that I love my husband and wife, and I will do absolutely nothing to damage that relationship. And other people, if you ask them if they're married, if they're looking for someone, they'll kind of hedge. Well, yeah, I'm sort of married. I'm unhappily married. Whatever. And there is a real difference. And sometimes you don't even have to talk to them. They just send out that message that they're interested, that they're available, that they are looking for someone else. I think there's a real difference between being frustrated and disappointed in a marriage. When you're just frustrated, your needs and expectations haven't yet been met. But if you're disappointed, your needs and expectations, you feel like they won't be met. And if you've reached the level of disappointment and you are looking for another relationship, chances are really good that you'll find it, if you're looking. Okay, my third question is a husband and wife justified in seeking sexual satisfaction with someone else if they are not experiencing this kind of gratification with their spouse? Mormons agree at the altar to seek sexual fulfillment only with their marriage partner. Because of this commitment, they have the obligation to help their marriage partners obtain that fulfillment. Turn over your handout to differences in sexual responses. I've listed these, and we don't have time for me to read them all. But I think it is really true that we have an obligation to work on our marriage, to make our marriage relationship work. I think we have an obligation to make our sexual relationship work. And I think it helps if you know what these differences are and you have realistic expectations of your spouse. And there are a lot of differences. If we don't expect the woman to, she kind of looks for intimacy and affection in a relationship. That's as important to her as the orgasm is to the man. And if you understand that, I think it really does help. And you can, there are a lot of things you can do to improve your sexual relationship. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 2 through 5, husbands and wives are admonished not to refrain from sexual interaction too long, lest either spouse be tempted to seek gratification elsewhere. Even back in New Testament times, we're told that that this is something you need to work out with your spouse, but it is part of your relationship and making the marriage work for both of you. Okay, and the one question that we were talking about this last night that I was wondering about is, are men less innately monogamous than women? It seems like, to me, they are. I think women feel that real emotional need. And to me, it seems like men are less innately that way. And part of it is biological, and it relates to these differences in sexual response. Okay, my last question is, how do you construct a marriage relationship that will allow enough freedom for the individuals to grow and reach their potential while cultivating an intimacy based on mutual trust and companionship? Now, my experience was that some people say, well, our relationship works because I just give my husband a real long leash and let him do whatever he wants. And to me, that didn't work very well, because whenever I gave my husband a long leash, he'd say, I need more space, and so I'd lengthen the leash a little bit, and he would abuse it. And because all I was doing was allowing him the opportunity to have a lot of other relationships, and for me that didn't work to allow a really long leash. I think the place to start strengthening the marriage relationship is to strengthen our individual lives. And I spent 5 years trying to put together the marriage, thinking there was something I could do, in a lot of counseling and whatever. And finally, I realized it wasn't my fault that he was unhappy, and that I was going to quit trying to fix it. I was going to focus on strengthening myself, strengthening my own, doing things that I wanted to do that would benefit me. And I think when you start strengthening your, stabilizing your individual lives, you will have a better relationship. And to strengthen your relationship, I think you need to get a mirror rather than a microscope and look at yourself rather than examining all the things that are wrong in your spouse and in your spouse's life. In conclusion, I think B.H. Roberts offered great advice to married couples when he stated, "In essentials, let there be unity. In non-essentials, liberty. And in all things, charity."
There seems to be a little confusion about how many children I have. The program says I have 4 children, and Robin said I have 3, and here I am talking about fidelity in marriage, so anything I have to say, I'm sure my credibility is shot. A discussion about fidelity in marriage seems a little odd to me. I mean, what are the real questions here? Is fidelity good for marriage? Is it bad? Is it necessary? Does it really matter at all? If we answer these questions from the Latter-day Saint perspective, then the discussion lasts slightly longer than a nanosecond. But if we take the relativistic humanist view, the dialogue never ends. And if the panel tries to answer these questions on a personal, emotional level, I think we'll probably hear endless anecdotes about relationships, and I think this discourse can be illuminating and even informative. But just like the gospel doctrine class that quickly deteriorates into how to raise kids, this approach adds nothing meaningful to our search for something higher and better. In the end, we'll still be without models and paradigms and direction, in other words, adrift and conclusionless. Now, I'm a conclusion-oriented kind of person, much to the dismay of my wife. I'm kind of closure-oriented. I want solutions. I want direction. And since I'm that way, and since I like to think of myself as a thinking and believing Latter-day Saint, I'm going to assume the Orthodox LDS point of view and then try to reason through it. That view is spouses practice fidelity, period. If I fail to convince myself, then maybe I have more thinking to do. And if I succeed, then hooray for the intellectual process and learning by study and faith. First, just a few random thoughts. And I'm a musician, and musicians work through statistics pretty loose and fast. So I've heard lots of statistics about infidelity. I'm not sure which ones are true. I see Tim Heaton here. He could probably set me straight on some of these. But these are the ones that I've read. 70% of American men cheat on their wives. 15% of them go to the other woman. And 75% of them stay with their wives. 80% of divorced men say they would remarry their ex-wives if given the chance. Sometime after the divorce, they come to that realization. This all comes from this new book that's out called How to Get Him Back from the Other Woman. And the authors list the following reasons why men stray. 1, midlife crisis. 2, bored with wife. 3, the opportunity was there. 4, pressure and stress. 5, depression. 6, husband needs space. That starts to sound familiar, doesn't it? 7, lack of attention. 8, basic wanderer. Now, these reasons sound so feeble and spineless. It makes me wonder what the real reasons are beneath such superficial answers. For instance, depression can't be a reason for infidelity because depression brings on a loss of interest in pleasure, not an enhancing of it. The genuine reasons often go unheard because men have difficulty with expressing their feelings. Now, I tried to detach myself from my gender-induced prejudices and posit some theories as to why 70% of men stray. So this is just me. I can't cite any research. But my first theory is that men are an iniquitous, unprincipled, uncaring, roguish race of human beings. And two, men are incapable of fidelity. Three, 70% of men marry the wrong woman. That's a possibility. Four, men are biologically predisposed to stray. And five, 70% of American men lack a fidelity gene. So, as I think about each of these, men are an iniquitous, unprincipled, uncaring, roguish race of human beings. I just know too many good men, and I can reject that outright. Now, there may be some feminists, maybe in another room right now, in fact, who concur with this view, but really my experience suggests otherwise. And men are incapable of fidelity. Well, I'm the living denial of that. Standing before you is Fidel. Seventy percent of American men marry the wrong woman. No, they don't. The women these 70% of men are married to are better than that. My own personal experience, and if my wife were here, she'd verify this, is that married women tend to be more interesting than married men. That's just my own experience. Besides, 80% of divorced men would rather be with their first wives than anyone else if given the chance. Now, men usually marry the right woman. Let me illustrate by beginning. I'm working loose now with these facts. If we start with 100 men, okay, 30 of them are happy and feel like they've married the right woman. 70 don't. Of the 70 that don't, 53 think enough of their first wives to wish that they were with them eventually. So that's quite a few. Of the 17 that go to the other woman, we can estimate maybe about 13 of them eventually come to realize that they'd rather remarry their first wives if given the chance. So that means roughly 96% of men are marrying the right woman. Now, is that pretty loose and fast? Men are biologically predisposed to stray, okay, while women are not. Now, there's a new branch of science called sociobiology. Actually, it's I guess, 10, 15 years old. And sociobiologists assert that humans instinctually desire to spread as many of their genes throughout the larger pool of the human family. Now, since men produce roughly 15 billion times more reproductive cells than women, their primal programming induces them to look beyond their spouse. But I think the idea that men want more sex than women, I mean, that's popular in our culture, and it's arguable, but the notion that they want it 15 billion times more is preposterous. You know, I've calculated that for a 70-year-old man, even thinking about sex 15 billion times during his lifetime would require about 20 fantasies per second. And that's per waking second. And even Wilt Chamberlain, you know, can't come close to that. Now, the last one I thought of was 70% of American men lack a fidelity gene that research geneticists have not yet located along the Y chromosome. I'm just going to continue to reject this idea until I hear it fall from the lips of Peter Jennings on the evening news. Now, a little more seriously here, I do believe that men may be getting a bum rap where infidelity is concerned. Why is it that when we think of the stereotypical unfaithful spouse, it's nearly always the man? Even the title of that book, How to Win Him Back from the Other Woman, shows a gender bias in the perception of infidelity. If 70% of American men have sex outside of marriage, to whom do they wander? I assume, in most cases, to an equal number of American women? Are these women merely accessories to an unfaithful act, or are they equal partners? Where are the numerical and sociological studies on these women? I'm sure some research has been done, but it doesn't play as well or as prominently as the descriptions of the philandering males of our society. Another reason I think males get a bum rap has to do with the way they handle marital stress, and it's different from the way women react. Women practice and hone their communication skills when they are young, and men never catch up to that. Just this week, the Department of Education released a report called The Condition of Education 1993, showing that while boys do better in math and science, girls do a lot better in verbal skills and surpass them. When girls become women and wives, they take these skills and plug them into a support network of other women. They discuss their spouses, their troubles, and their fears without worrying about being judged as being weak or unable to handle difficulty. Men eschew such uncomfortable, embarrassing discussions. They lack experience and the verbal wherewithal to describe or clarify their predicament. Moreover, they can't access a network where they might comfortably discuss feelings and frustrations. Besides, they don't want to be perceived as feeble and powerless. As a result, when a marriage sours, the hapless wife's anxieties get transmitted throughout a network of supportive, caring women, including her family, friends, and neighbors. Her point of view becomes public. Men married to or associated with this network and these network women receive reports and updates that are well-developed, finely-tuned, and often articulate. These descriptions of the situation often have to do with the beastly husband in this troubled marriage. And because these men have not discussed such issues within their own network, they can either agree with the viewpoint of the network women or disagree in some cursory, pedestrian way. Even though there are two sides to assess, one side's viewpoint is nourished and develops quickly, while the other struggles to be expressed, let alone supported and understood. And I think this explains why men's reasons for straying sound so impotent and unconvincing. Another random thought I had was I believe most cultures and religion certainly contain mythical, if not scriptural, models of fidelity. For instance, maybe the story of Noah's Ark is a story of fidelity. You know, the animals are going two by two. And the story of Adam and Eve. And Eve is a paragon of fidelity. God didn't create a group of people at once. He didn't create Adam and Eve, Bob and Carol, and Ted and Alice. And I might add parenthetically, he didn't create Adam and Steve or Adam and Madam. On a personalized level, ritualized covenants of fidelity help me to attach significance to my most important relationship. And without marriage is just a piece of paper. Fidelity nurtures the intimacy I share with my wife and helps heal the fractures when they appear in our marriage. It's the outward trust of one's inner love and respect. This is starting to sound like a Sunday school lesson. But even when I factor out religious arguments favoring fidelity, societal ones remain. Since infidelity brings on marital discord and divorce, infidelity cannot escape all the blame that attends the results of divorce. According to the cover article in last June's Time, rising divorce rates mean that more than 40% of all children born between 1970 and 1984 are likely to spend much of their childhood in single-parent homes. In 1960, 5% of children were living with their mothers, only compared to 25% today. Experts point out that children of divorced parents suffer more crime, drug abuse, and depression, and school failure, and studies of young criminals show that 70% came from fatherless homes. Children from broken families drop out of high school at twice the average rate. 5 years after a couple splits, more than a third of their children experience moderate or severe depression, and after 10 years, a significant number appear to be troubled, drifting and underachieving. After 15 years, many are struggling to develop strong love relationships of their own. Daughters of divorce, in particular, often experience great difficulty establishing a realistic view of men in general, and sons of divorce who live with their mothers risk growing up with low self-esteem, becoming overly dependent on women, and emotionally rigid. Now I'm starting to sound like a conference talk, I think. And I realized that I just brought the factor of children into this issue, and I think it may be a different issue than just without children, but I think it needs to be aired. So I conclude with, I realize we're familiar with a lot of these statistics, but the data tell us something. I think to the extent that fidelity moderates divorce and the associated societal ills, we're all better off to embrace it. Thanks.
Robin introduced me about as simply as could be done, I guess. I'm sure I have three kids and a husband currently. And before I went to law school, I taught high school. And so I have a background in education and worked basically in education all my life. I'm not particularly an expert on this topic. When Robin asked me to speak on it a couple of months ago, I took a long time to think about it because I don't have any professional expertise. I would have been much more comfortable speaking about prayer in schools yesterday or church-state issues and things like that. I've had few experiences with divorce professionally, and only a couple of those have involved infidelity, usually the more simple kind. I have, though, talked and suffered with and about several friends whose marriages have deteriorated and usually ended in divorce. But even in those situations, infidelity was only a symptom and not the disease itself. Perhaps my greatest claim to expertise on this topic is that I've been married for 20 years this summer, about 13 of those happily. And I can speak with some expertise about fidelity in my own life and marriage and about the meaning and the importance that it has had over the years. I had three kinds of, quotations isn't quite right, but for lack of a better word, that captured what I wanted to talk about. The first one is from The Art of Loving by Eric Fromm. And that's, I realize, one of the older self-help books. They're a lot more clever and modern ones that Tom was quoting, but this is kind of one of the first ones I read. To love somebody is not just a strong feeling. It's a decision. It's a judgment. It's a promise. If love were only a feeling, there would be no basis for the promise to love each other forever. A feeling comes and it may go. How can I judge that it will stay forever when my act does not involve judgment and decision? This same idea was echoed by... I think I got my pages mixed up here, by C.S. Lewis. And I don't know who came first, or I should be able to figure that out, but the ideas are very similar. The promise made when I am in love, and because I am in love, to be true to the beloved as long as I live, commits one to being true, even if I cease to be in love. A promise must be about things that I can do, about actions. No one can promise to go on feeling in a certain way. He might as well promise never to have a headache or always to feel hungry. So in my mind, echoing what those two experts have said on relationships, fidelity is not about feeling. It's not about feeling love or feeling loved even. It's about a decision that's made sometime during a marriage, hopefully sooner rather than later, that one chooses to be faithful and will remain faithful. I've observed this decision among the people I work with, live with, go to school with, is nearly a palpable one. It's really clear to me and has been clear to me in my life that... there are certain people who are clearly faithful people and have no thought, no matter how good of friends we become, that we would be anything other than friends. And I think that's a very interesting kind of notion that you choose, and that choice is clear to the people that you are close to. I also have little patience with the rationalization or explanation, whatever you want to call it, that we never intended this to happen. we couldn't do anything about our feelings because of this same idea that it's not something, it's not a feeling that we're talking about. We're talking about actions, and we're talking about the things you chose to do based on how you felt. And I think all of us are in control of what we do, even if we can't control what we feel. The second idea, and I realize this is the kind of talk that or discussion that Tom was saying, we'll have some anecdotal war stories and not reach any conclusions, but that's kind of my way. I'm not a person who comes to closure, so you're going to have to, Tom's going to have to indulge me in my wandering. He's known me for a long time. The second idea I have comes from a book called The Book of Merlin. I don't know if you... I kind of am obsessed with all King Arthur things and Merlin things, and this is one of the more obscure ones. But this takes place... T.H. Watt wrote the book. Merlin comes back to King Arthur when he's an old and bitter man, and he said he had reached the stage, the book goes, he had reached the stage at which it was not worthwhile to hold an old man's to hide an old man's misery. And Merlin tries to revive a dying friend and king. And the book goes on to say, it was worse than he had feared. He sat down, took the limp hand, and began to wheedle. One more try, he asked. We are not quite done. What is the use of trying? It is a thing which people do. And that's kind of the other idea that I always think about in marriage, that marriage and fidelity is really about trying and trying again and again and again. And if you stumble, you pick up and you try again. And I like to believe the notion, the gospel notion, that you keep trying. And you don't end marriage if there's any other recourse. And I've seen enough of it professionally to know that sometimes there's not. But I do think that it's about trying. I do think, too, that I'm not trying to... I don't want to make this sound too simplistic. I think that people who work together and travel together and spend a lot of time with each other and share experiences together are naturally attracted to each other. And I think there's a lot of sexual attraction sometimes. I wouldn't deny that. And I wouldn't have that otherwise. It makes working with people and talking with people of both sexes interesting. On the other hand, being faithful to a spouse emotionally as well as physically is about always recognizing that it's an effort, that it's something we're trying to do and something we're committed to. As I talked about earlier. And it's something, again, that though you make mistakes, though you stumble into things that you never intended to happen, you don't act on those, or if you act on them in some way or some small way, you get up again and try harder. My final thoughts that I kind of hearken back to when I think about this topic are some... pieces and some parts of very amateurish poetry I wrote more than 15 years ago. And I've never read these to anybody. I read them myself a lot. I shouldn't say I've never read them to anybody. I've read them a couple of times in a couple of very small church classes that I was teaching. And I've given them to Robin in some of her... difficulties. But I've never read them publicly, and I've certainly never read them to a group of people like you guys that I don't know most of. But as I look back on them, maybe I'm a little less sensitive than I used to be, partly because it's about 15 years old now. And there are some few bits of real insight in there from times when my life and my marriage was much less certain than it is today. And I kind of want to tell you or give you some of those, that same insight. Again, not because it's great poetry, but because it does contain, I think, a few kernels of insight that I'm even amazed that I wrote so many years ago. And I'll just read part of it. You don't have to hear all of it. And this was written on my birthday, actually, in 1976. It will be a hard time to pass through again. I still feel occasionally, or at odd and lonely moments, a clenching in my heart. I still question abruptly, and I remember and hurt. Traveling inward can be painful. But oh, what I've learned in only a year. That loving is hard, perhaps the greatest challenge of life. That being lovable is even harder. That there is something to be said for endurance, and even occasionally for holding your tongue. That sometimes, in some emotions, some events are not forgettable. That being afraid doesn't solve anything. That bitterness only feeds on itself. That trust can return, though slowly. That I'm tougher than I thought I was. That I wish I'd had to explore myself earlier. That true friends are important and rare. That I like beagles, especially their ears. That you have to stick up for yourself, even or especially in love. That loneliness comes from within. This is the part I like the best. That you can't live in fear of being hurt, or deceived, or even trampled on. You can only fear hurting, deceiving, forgetting, and trampling. I want to be able to call back at will the bitterness, the cringing, the humiliation, the emptiness, the anger, the strength, the independence, and the childlikeness that I've discovered this year. I want to live life when it's cold and dense, when it's meaningful, meaningless, and challenging, even when I find it ruthless and unfair. And the second one I wrote in April of 1976. Sometimes in a life there are events or people or decisions not made, or mistakes or steps that can't be shrugged off like passing thoughts or maturely labeled out of perspective. Sometimes things really count, and there's no going home again. And you try not to be hasty, but to retain your own dignity. And you try, only admitting it in desperate moments, to protect whatever's left unhurt. You search into yourself inside out for some reservoir of wisdom and foresight that should well up in a person for such times. But there's only a few pale experiences and the things you've read, and your pools of thought and idle wanderings. And you decide or not, or step or don't. And years later, you look back and decide that you could have been more wise, or should have been less impatient, or stronger, or just a little less young. I never experienced infidelity. I was never a victim exactly of infidelity, but I could show here, and it was a painful learning experience that my marriage survived, and I'm glad to say it did, and I'm glad I wasn't one of those statistics that Tom quoted, but I do think it's something that you work on, you try to do better at every day, and you never think that it's not going to be part of your life, because though you make decisions I talked about earlier, things change, and a lot of things occur that you don't expect to occur and that you wouldn't have happened to yourself, but you just kind of keep on moving through it has been my experience. Thank you.
My name is Michelle Haas, and I intend to speak mostly today about my experience as a mediator. One of the things I do, my day job, as I'm fond of calling it, is that I mediate when other people get into conflicts and problems. And it's my job to work with people in such a way that they can find an outcome that they can live with, something that is workable in their own lives. Sometimes it means bringing relationships to a close, divorces, and my husband and I also do what we call business divorces. But it's finding a way to end something with grace and closure with the best possible outcome so that no one in the situation comes out as a victim. Sometimes it's my job to see how I can continue a relationship, often at work, often in corporations, about how people who have to live together but don't know how to, in business marriages, I guess you'd call it, how to keep the thing alive in such a way that people can still work productively together. This is a difficult topic for me. Just this last week, a couple of days ago, my parents celebrated their 57th wedding anniversary. And they are old enough now that their health is failing, and I have watched as they have progressively become more and more confined to their own home and to living with each other virtually 24 hours a day because it's very hard for them to get out of the house, and looked at their marriage and wondered how it has kept alive for all the years that it has. And through all the 8 kids and the umpty-ump grandkids and all of that, and I have noticed those moments of tenderness and affection between these people in their 80s, and I am so impressed that they have managed to keep this marriage alive through a lot of years and a lot of adventures. I did not. I am in a second marriage. I'm what's called a reconstituted marriage, like orange juice, you know. My husband over here, I was born and raised here as a Mormon. My husband was not. So bind some cultural things, some religious things, some experience, and we're working on a second chance. We're working at putting something together again and doing it right this time, even though I'm not always sure what is right and how to make it work. One of the advantages that I have in particular, this is a gift to me, is that when my husband and I sometimes go out and mediate together, because sometimes it works to have a woman and a man in the situation so that neither gender feels like they're at a disadvantage. And I watch what's happened to other people's marriages and other people's relationships. I have a gift of saying, wow, I would never do that. I'm sure glad I don't, and I'll never go home, honey, and try it on you. But then it's my job to put it back together. So I work on some of my own experience. My dad was a shrink, and my brother here is a shrink, and I think he puts people back together too. So when I find relationships, the place I usually get them is at the end of this process on one site where people have decided that it's dead, and they either have to figure out how to resuscitate it in some workable manner or end it gracefully. And the thing that I have been struck with, particularly about marriages and divorces, is that it is very difficult in our culture, our Mormon culture in particular, to admit that you're marriageable. There's very little social support within the Mormon tradition for supporting people whose relationships are in trouble. We tend to put on a facade. We tend to try to make things look good on Sunday and then agonize the other days of the week. Just as a thought experiment, I'd like each person in the room now to think of a marriage that you know right now that's in trouble. Just take a minute and bring one to mind, including your own, if that's the case. How many of you know of a marriage that's somewhere within your neighborhood or your ward or your social group of relatives that's in trouble? Okay. I want to ask you another question. How much support have you given to either one of those people? How much support have you given to their children? How much have you extended yourself? How much have you made it all right for people to say, man, I'm not succeeding at this? How much of forgiveness, non-judgmental acceptance, and embracing have you done of those other people? One of the reasons I believe that infidelity is so devastating in a Mormon community is not that we make promises over temple altars to be together forever, is that we don't allow ourselves very much latitude about permission to not do it right, to make mistakes. there isn't very much permission. So one of the first things I would advocate is that you, sitting right where you are now, must have been interested enough in this topic to show up. And I'm asking, how much support have you given to those people who are in troubled situations? Secondly, one of the things that impresses me a lot right now is that the costs of fidelity are so extraordinarily high. And one of the highest right now is, I'll just go ahead and work with this a minute, is sexually transmitted diseases. I had understood that after a questionable sexual encounter, that if you go 6 years without getting AIDS or any of the other sexually transmitted diseases that are available, you could consider yourself safe. I now understand it's 20 years. You have to go 20 years after a sexual encounter with another person before you know that you're not going to get AIDS. Or some of the other interesting mutating varieties of sexually transmitted diseases. Also, if you have sex with another person, you're having sex with all the people they had sex with. And who knows what that is? The consequences of infidelity are extraordinary now in ways they have never been. If you have loved and committed yourself and made that decision that both Carol and Tom have talked about, that you decide you're going to be faithful, you have made health decisions for this person that you're with besides yourself. So the consequences just become mega consequences in ways they didn't used to be. Moreover, how many of you have teenage kids or young adult kids? Do you ever hold your breath when they go out the door on a date? As well you should. What have you taught your children about staying faithful? For any for moral reasons, practical reasons, health reasons, or whatever reasons have you taught? How well have you set your children up by your example or your explicit teaching? And it's hard. I have a 15-year-old son who, when I have tried to give him the birds and the bees lecture, says, "Oh, Mom, I already know all of that." And I said, "That's what I'm afraid of, because I think I know where you learned it from your friends." And it's not easy to do. So fidelity begins early. It begins before you get to the altar. It begins with you setting an example. It begins as you, for you as a very young person. And I guess the last thing I want to say is, one of the things I've noticed dealing with people in conflict in relationships is it's often not acceptable, or can you imagine yourself, let's just try this, imagine yourself doing this. Imagine yourself going home to your spouse and saying, "Honey, I am so strongly sexually attracted to somebody that I've considered going off and having a physical relationship with them." Now, did you say, "No way would I ever do that. No, I'm sorry. I mean, but I know a lot of lives that would have been spared a lot of grief with rightness been available within the marriage. I've discovered that love is the ability to be honest also, even in the face of some hellacious issues. My area of expertise is communication, and a lot of what I found out of communication doesn't have to do with techniques. It has to do with willingness. It's not in your brain. It's not your education. It isn't your credentials. It isn't how fancy. It isn't your vocabulary. Are you just willing? Are you willing to come to your spouse, or your children for that matter, and say the hard thing? "I'm scared. I'm worried. This doesn't feel right. I need some support. Help." Tough things. We're not trained to say that. We don't give our kids latitude to learn how to say those things. And yet they could save so much. So So I guess I'll close, turn the time over to my husband with the idea just that willingness, aside from everything else that's been said here, willingness to do things you may not have done may be the saving grace and may have more to do with fidelity than sexual statistics or gender arguments or anything else.
I really feel like a fish out of water here. I agreed to do something that I didn't fully understand when the opportunity was laid in front of me. And so I'm LDS, not culturally. I came here in 1980 from the Midwest at the University of Utah. I sat at the end of the table chuckling about how strong the impulse was to get out of this room. And I looked at whoever it was that left coughing, and I thought, that's good, I could try that. I don't have anything to tell anybody. I mean, heavenly days. I'm learning as I go. The only thing that I have to say is that I keep bumping into what Tom was talking about, how few people there are that I feel secure enough or safe enough to talk about anything very personally, because rightfully or wrongfully, I mean, there aren't any points in being vulnerable. That's just being foolish. But I did spend some time talking with Michelle about, well, what do you think this is going to be? Who's going to be there? What kind of this isn't a get a bunch of people together and have them share trade secrets kind of thing, is it? Because about the only thing that I've learned, and I'm still learning it, is that what I learned how to do, and this was prompted about 2 weeks ago. I saw a fellow I'm co-authoring with, and we watched an old movie that had been a fond movie of mine as a kid. Shane, ancient movie, but it's been around long enough, some people have seen it. I remember wanting to see that film over and over again. Every time it came out at a theater, I'd bug my folks to go see it. But I hadn't seen it in years and years and years, since I was maybe 9, I think, was the last time I saw Shane. And so I watch it now at 48, and I was struck with how much I used to identify with the kid at the end of the movie, with Alan Ladd riding off into the sunset, right? And how much I'd learned how to become that guy who rides off in the sunset. Essentially what I learned how to do was when I don't know how to talk my way out of situations that, and I feel as if I don't have any skills for working here, I leave. And I've been doing that all my life. And so what I learned about relationships is when it comes time to cover the thin ice where there's some risk, I leave. And that's a kind of infidelity. You know, I thought, well, as long as I was physically, dry mouth is here, as long as I was physically faithful, that was it. But Tom was talking about the number of fantasies, right, that go through. Part of learning how to stay for me has been sort of working with fantasy, because I really do believe that unpopular person to quote these days, especially in any kind of feminist circle, Friedrich Nietzsche, who said something that I never knew how to understand, but I think maybe I'm coming to understand. There's no hope. that what you got is what you got. Leaving, there's no place to go. There is no Western sunset that's going to be any different from any place else. So I kind of buy the 99 or 98 or whatever percent, the stats that our musician here was being sort of improvisational with, but I like them, so, I'll use them. I think I did marry before, and I think I married the right woman this time. It is a decision. I mean, for me, that's the only way I know how to do it. I was interested, I don't know, do any of you know anything about, since I'm the last one, and that's about all I have to say. I mean, I don't have any words of wisdom for anybody. I can just give you a little bit of my experience. Does anybody know anything? I was in Fraser, Colorado, 3 weeks ago when I was working with this fellow that I'm co-authoring. And I learned, because he subscribed to the Denver Post, and it was delivered up in this mountain cabin every day, that there is a huge congregation of men called Men Who Keep Promise Keepers, or something like that. And they are apparently the coach of the Denver Broncos is the sort of leader or guru or whatever, but I don't know anything about it. And, like most newspapers, if you don't know the entering premises, you can't follow the news stories because it's just all on the surface. But I think there's something happening with a number of men, at least the ones I talk to, which aren't that large a number. But I think that realization is that there's no place to go. I mean, I think it's ecofeminism tells us that. Everything is telling us, what we've got is what we've got. And there is no hope, and it's now. And that's where integrity is, in those choices, and in the choices to keep making those choices. That's all I have to say.
Because they are taping these sessions, I'm going to follow the microphone around to those of you who have questions and comments, and if you have a specific person you want to answer a question, address that. So we have a few minutes. Anyone have questions?
I've been taking notes here. I suppose the one thing that I'm dissatisfied about is that there's an overall assumption here that, we've been using a euphemism called fidelity, or what I understand to be faithfulness, but faithfulness is not necessarily a sexual... what we're talking about here is for lack of a better term, sexual exclusivity. That is the issue, sexual exclusivity. And I suppose sexual exclusivity does not necessarily have to be an issue of monogamy or polygyny or whatever, because monogamy and polygyny, for example, are issues of marriage. Sexual exclusivity simply refers to decisions to be made about whether or not one should remain sexually exclusive to one person. And that's it. So what I find dissatisfying is that most of you had these assumptions that because I suppose sexual exclusivity is a good, and that to talk about alternatives is a taboo, that that I suppose we should not each of you decided individually that that we should not talk about that. But the problem is that one could take every single one of the arguments that were made and make good arguments for why sexual, for lack of a better term again, why sexual inclusivity would not be an equally good alternative. The idea, for example, of STDs is not really a compelling argument for sexual exclusivity. Neither is any of a number of arguments for example, put it up. What I got from one of them was that one should just put up with it because that is with sexual exclusivity, even if you're sexually restless, because one perhaps, I suppose, should overcome libidinous weakness. But all of these arguments are very weak. The issue here is sexual. Why not have sexual inclusivity? I'll end my comment here. Is that what it seems to me that it's very possible to say that the real problem is a societal problem that we should probably heed the words of the old theoretical psychoanalysts who talk about the fact that we are that we do live in a bitterness society, that we are repressed, that repression points to perpetuates a lot of social ills, that we are polymorphously perverse, as Freud had put it, that perhaps the problem is not sexual, is not trying to put up with sexual exclusivity, but rather what alternatives are there to sexual to promote sexual inclusivity. That is, why not, for example, people just get together and say, my wife, I want to go have sex with somebody. Want to join me?
I'm going to make one comment before I pass the mic, and that is, I don't think I was really talking about sexual infidelity. Totally, I think that if your spouse is in love with someone else, it's whether he's having sex with them or not, is as emotionally hard on you as sexual infidelity. And I think that that's just not how you treat someone you've chosen to be in a relationship with. And so for me, whether it's sexual or not makes no difference. And I think women, I attach a lot of importance to sex. And so for me, I couldn't be like you advocate. That wouldn't work because the emotional intimacy and the love has to be there, and that's real important. And so that is all tied up into this relationship issue. So let me ask.
I heard a lot of assumptions in what you were saying. I am pretty ferociously anti-Freudian, daughter of a shrink, former daughter-in-law of a shrink, sister of a shrink, and I do some amateur shrinking when I mediate with people. And all I can say is that I think it would serve you well to speak for yourself when you say we are a sexually repressive society. Is that a fair representation? We are repressed. We are whatever, did you say?
That's demographically true.
Well, see, I think it's an opinion, but... See, I guess I have a problem talking about repressiveness when I watch what my children watch on television and I listen to the lyrics of the music that they bring home, and so I have trouble finding that terribly repressive. That's a real head-scratcher for me. I don't know if you have kids or not, but the other thing is you say, we are repressed. I'm not repressed. So be careful who you speak for. Well, first of all, I've learned that when people speak we, I've spent years studying communication, and one of the first time bombs that goes off for me is when somebody says we, because one of the things I want to say is, who are you speaking for? Now, what I've noticed on this panel today is that most of the people who have stood up to speak were speaking for themselves only. They were giving you a sense of what the experience of the consequences of emotional, sexual, spiritual, and other kinds of non-exclusivity have been. My sense is that they have been personally absolutely devastating. My own experience with it is that it absolutely wrecked everything that I had ever believed was true in the world. my life will never be the same. I'm not saying it's good, and I'm not saying it's bad. I have had friends die of AIDS. I can count four now. And to me, the idea of being faithful, if for no other reason, that you continue to have a kind of health, that you can continue to have some enjoyment and fulfillment in life, is an extraordinarily compelling argument. Extraordinarily. And the other issue that maybe women consider more than men, I don't know this, is that sexual activity with another partner has a high potential of resulting in pregnancy. I personally know several couples who discovered that a wife was pregnant by someone who was other than the husband. And I can't tell you what happened in those marriages to the children. Half children of one spouse or another, or a full child. If you do nothing else, you must take care of the results of your sexual activity. You get to live with the consequence of sexual activity, whatever it is. Children are the consequence, and you need to live with the consequence.
I feel nervous about coming up to the microphone since I've already eaten. I guess, you know, first off, you know, the discussion here has been extremely good in terms of, well, you know, physical or sexual fidelity. Yes, I do agree with it. You know, the costs to both people are just far too high, I think, and just destroying a relationship when one crosses the line. My first wife was, during the time she was terminally ill, I just, you know, that was just something I, at the time, I never, you know, would have considered. But Robin, in her introduction, I think just raised these additional points, not sexual infidelity per se, but what borderline might exist in emotional infidelity in terms of how far can or should non-sexual friendships with people of the opposite sex go. Relations with women at work or women's relations with men. And I guess they're the questions raised. You find them interesting. There's certainly this added dimension of, you know, that tingle or something that's there. And I guess just putting that question, you know, in terms of how should we deal with this aspect of our lives?
Well, I kind of talked to that issue a little bit. Does anyone else, Tom and Carol, have a comment about that? I think that's one of the biggest issues is having, it's important for me to have friends that are of the opposite sex, and how to structure that relationship so that if I were married, I would not be endangering my marriage. I think that to me is the hardest part about relationships among sexes.
Let me just try some ideas, and I don't pretend to have any answers that work for everybody, but I do have a lot of friends who are men, and I work with a lot of men, and I travel with a lot of men. And it's not without attendant problems, even if you only consider what people think. And that doesn't usually bother me a lot, but it bothers me. But I'm aware of it. And anything, any answer, any, you know, any, not even advice, but any kind of comments I might make sound real simplistic. But I've resolved it in my life, and by saying I've made a decision, and there is not, I'm not going to do anything that compromises that decision. That's not to say I don't have good friends who are men. I spend more time most days of the week with my boss, who's male, than I do with my husband. But I'm not about to compromise my marriage. I've been too close to that, and it's too painful, and there's too much at stake, like you mentioned. And for me, again, just speaking for myself, it's a matter of decision. And for the men, the male friends I've talked, or talked, and it's a hard thing to talk about, even you know, if you were a communication expert. But the men I've talked around about this subject with feel the same way. They're at least, you know, the ones I'm friends with, that their marriage is not negotiable. It's that's a primary relationship in their life, and they would do nothing that jeopardizes that. And people can think what they want about those kinds of relationships that I've had and that people I've, you know, work with have. But my feeling is, and I know some of their feeling is, that my commitment is intact. I think it's difficult. I don't pretend that it's not without risks, and it's not without temptations. I don't just say, and so I see those people as asexual. I don't. But on the other hand, I'm not going to do anything that would risk some of the heartache I've seen in some of my friends and in some close family members.
I wanted to say just one more thing, too. I have a couple of women friends who absolutely firmly believe, that are married, that they cannot have a relationship with a man, because every time they have, the men look at it as a sexual thing, and they're not looking at it as a sexual relationship, and that difference in their interpretation does not allow them to be friends. But that's not been my experience, and so I don't have that belief. Right here.
Just a question to you, Robin. Did you say that you couldn't stand the thought of your husband loving somebody else, regardless of the sexual part, the physical part? Just that you couldn't. Is that boiled down to you want to possess him, or I mean, isn't the ultimate thing here, we believe in the law of eternal progression, which should progress to we loving everybody. And how can we approach loving everybody if we want to possess the person that we're supposed to love?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm kind of a monogamous person, and to me, I can only love one person at a time. And maybe men, you know, maybe a spouse could love me and another woman, and it shouldn't feel threatening. But to me, it threatens my relationship. And I think whether they're having physical intimacy, if they're obsessed with that person, if they are in love with that person, then I think our relationship is ending. They're looking at they're being critical of me. I don't know that you can because I can't imagine it loving two people equally and being in a marriage and just having sex with the one you're married with. That's right. Like I said, to me, it doesn't work. It doesn't work because, you know, I'll grant that it's a possibility that a man could.
I'm not saying
that.
To love more than one person, or what?
Yeah. Is there a big difference though between having sex with someone's body and having sex with someone's mind? You know, I mean, it.
Yeah. Right. Erotic love. Yeah, I think so. Well, I think this is a little bit about what I'm concerned with, and that is that the first person that came up the microphone spoke about the societal problems of sexual exclusivity. I see it as a greater societal problem of intimacy. I think that narrows down even more within the Mormon culture, and as one of the speakers yesterday said that Mormons often use church work as a substitute or a alternate to developing intimacy within their own marriages, because they're busy doing their church work and they're doing what's right, they're doing what God wants, and they therefore that's all right. I see this as a real problem that I would like to see some addressing too, because there are people like me that were born and raised sixth generation in the church. We grew up with the attitude of chastity. We've had no relationship with any other person than the one person we've been married to for 30 years. But we have very shallow, very empty, very meaningless marriages. And I see that throughout the entire church. I set the example for my child, and I still see children, and I still see my children being involved sexually way too young with too many people. And I think part of that comes from their seeing the emptiness that's within the marriage we have, that's within the marriage of the people that are their home teachers and all that. So I see the broader, greater problem being that one of intimacy. I think that if we could somehow get past the barriers of all those things, and we could be unconditional with our love, and we could be free to be who we are and love everybody in an unconditional way, then we would be able to provide the intimacy to our marriage partner on an equal basis, and therefore the need for the sexual inclusivity would not be the issue that it is.
Is that the church? Do you think that's exclusive to the church?
I think it's throughout the world, but I think it's a bigger, broader problem right within the church.
Rarely do I get to make this point, which I feel very strongly about, and it has to do with male and female friendships. And that's what I'm talking about, is male and female friendships. It isn't every man who can be a friend to a woman, and it isn't every woman who can be a friend to a man. I do believe that every married woman should have a man friend, and I believe that every married man is fortunate to have a woman friend. I don't say things that I haven't tried myself. I'm fortunate that I can be a friend to a man, and I'm fortunate that I have men who are friends to me. And these friendships, one of which I prize, I met a lot of soldiers in World War II, but one especially, and he happens to be from Utah. And I met him in Missouri in December of 1942, and we have been friends for these now over 50 years. We have shared our pains and our tragedies and good times. We have gone out together. Another friend I have is one who recently died. His wife had Alzheimer's, and we shared much as friends. Another instance in my life, we were living in Germany, as I did for 19 years, and my husband was in the States at that time. And it was our 25th wedding anniversary, and he didn't even send me a card. He didn't even call on the phone. But I determined I was not going to stay home. Now, my home teacher at that time, who is from this state and lives in this state and was working overseas in Germany, whose wife had died of cancer, and he had his four children over there. So I called him up and I said, Clyde, It's my 25th wedding anniversary, and I don't want to stay home. Let's go to the opera. And we did. Now, needless to say, there were some LDS who raised their eyebrows. I knew where I was coming from. He knew his position, and it didn't matter what anybody else said or thought. Now, not everyone can do what I've done. I know that. But I hope this has given you something to think about. Now, what I'm going to say to finalize this, by the way, you said you're from the Midwest. Where in the Midwest? Well, I come from a more Midwest part where we shoot straight from the shoulder and straight from the hip, and if somebody's offended, they don't get mad at them. So what I'm going to say is pretty strong stuff. But when you wives and husbands are looking for friends and relationships with the opposite sex, keep your brains in your head and not in your pants.
Well, I think that's a good comment to end this discussion on, and we thank you all for being here. Bye.